Solve, secure, protect. Look to Patel for the independent thinking and cross-disciplinary focus it takes to advance security and safety in a changing world. They provide their clients with integrated solutions that secure our nation and help solve challenges within infrastructure, environment, emerging threats, and deployable mission-ready technology. Their teams leverage their deep expertise to develop science and technology for a healthier, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit Patel.org to learn how Patel makes the impossible possible. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. Thanks for listening. In this episode, we are recording from the exhibit hall of AOC 2022. We are bringing you a special episode each day, taking a closer look at this concept of an EMSO playbook that is the theme of the show here this week. I think the EMSO playbook is a good way to think about all the capabilities, elements, and how they integrate together, all the capabilities, the people, the training, everything that we need to have for EMS superiority. And as I've said before, EMS superiority is really the backbone to mission success across all domains. So it's an important discussion to really understand the big picture and everything that goes in and really try not to leave anything out in our discussion. So to help me with that here today, I have a good friend and colleague, John Knowles. He is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Electromagnetic Dominance. He has been a regular guest here on From the Crow's Nest, and I appreciate having him back here for this first episode here at the convention, just to talk a little bit about what we're hearing on the EMSO playbook here this week and what are some of the themes and topics that we expect to cover over the next few days and what does it mean for our community. So welcome to From the Crow's Nest, John. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be back here. It's been a long time since been here, so it's great.
Yeah, we've only been able to record virtually here over the last year or so that we've been doing this, so it's good to sit down and chat with you in person. Basically, to get started, you know, I was going to pull a prank on you a little bit and just say, you know, like, give me your thoughts and just let you go off for about 30 minutes and make my job a lot easier. But, you know, I think the best way is to really kind of start from the beginning of what we're dealing with here. You know, this is the first day, so we're only at the front end of some of these conversations. But we've already had a few good ones on the international perspective. And so, you know, given the situation over in Ukraine, you know, we had NATO Transformation Command speak to us early this morning to kick us off, as well as the Artificial Intelligence Office in DOD. So I want to kind of touch on two of those two seemingly disparate topics, but we'll try to weave them together. But let's speak from an international big picture perspective. Oftentimes when we talk about EMSO, it's kind of U.S. focused, but there's a huge piece of this that's obviously we have to deal with now with, you know, what does that mean from NATO's perspective? And I wanted to know, get your thoughts on that to start.
Yeah, so I think that having the first speaker from NATO this morning was excellent. When I first heard the topic theme for the NATO, the EMSO playbook, my first thought was, okay, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, U.S. And my immediately though, I thought there's multiple, I don't know if you'd say multiple playbooks or multiple pages into the playbook, and they're not just U.S. pages. We're not just looking at a U.S. playbook. We have NATO partners, we have security partners in the U.S. that, and again, around the world. And so, again, it's an international community, international profession. And so when I think about the playbook or the playbook concept, I think first, being an editor of a magazine, you know, what about language? Are we speaking the same, are we using the same terms? And what do they mean to our partners in the middle of a conflict? And so some of our basic U.S. terminology isn't quite aligned with NATO. And when we speak in the heat of conflict, in the middle of an operation, when you need to make split-second decisions, are we literally going to be talking the same language in a conflict? And I think back to an anecdote I heard from another German general, actually German Air Force general, back at AOC Europe show in Berlin, and he made this point about Libya, and he said when a particular threat came up, that it was an erroneous threat, but they thought there was like a double-digit threat that popped up, which wasn't in Libya at the time. And the U.S. said, "Oh, we're going to get that with some electronic attack," and we were referencing growlers, but to them it was they didn't understand necessarily. So basically, what happened was everybody got out of the airspace really fast, but there was just a language break because they don't have support jammers, and so they know that we have them and we use them, but they weren't sure if that was a lethal seed. Some sort of harm or something like that. So it was just an interesting, point that when we speak in our language, in our terminology, our partners aren't necessarily schooled in that. Mm-hmm. And if another NATO nation starts using NATO terminology, how well schooled are we in that?
So how do you begin to address that? Because I mean, we've talked the issue of lexicon, and it's complicated enough even within the U.S. I mean, we have issues of are the services speaking the same language when we talk about this? Does it go to training, or does it go to, we talk about the services here, man, train, and equip for the joint force, and then the joint force obviously has to integrate with the international, with NATO forces and so forth. So is it a theater training issue that needs to be more addressed, or what do you think are some of the possible solutions or ways to address that lexicon problem overseas?
I think a lot of it is where it fundamentally comes into play is in operations. And so I think you need, in the coalition training, the coalition training should be pushing out the need for a common terminology. And so that you don't have situations like the Libya thing wasn't a big deal, but it was because the threat wasn't, it was just an erroneous threat. But
the threats over in Ukraine are real and much more advanced, and you probably have less decision time to deal with that miscommunication.
Exactly. And so that's the thing about EW is it's evolved. It's actually got it's amazing how much common terminology we have and common understanding in the West, but at the same time, it's not perfect, and mm-hmm. that's what happens in operations. So I think it comes out of coalition training, and it comes out of from there. If you're having communication problems in a training session, exercise, you need to start working on that there, and then it rolls up into doctrine and language and things like that across the countries. But if we're going to, I think Ukraine to me is a very significant conflict in many ways, but it's showing like Europe that we're going to be fighting as a coalition, and we need to definitely, no football team has a playbook where the different pages have different languages on them.
So from the NATO perspective, we're adapting to the conflict, we're learning to work together. Progress is being made. There's some good. You can see some good trends happening on that front. The other theater, of course, then is the Pacific. NATO's not there. So, are there lessons that we can learn that we can export to our partners in the Pacific? Or how does? I mean, it's one thing to learn a lesson over there, but the reality is that with the global, the evolving global threats. I mean, we could be having two theater efforts going on at the same time. And how do we take one lesson and learn it in a different theater with different partners and different ally constructs? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on how we take what we've learned from NATO here in looking at Europe and apply it to the Pacific theater?
Well, it's interesting because NATO is a multi-layered partnership. And so you've got government to government, you've got military to military, and then even at the industrial level, industrial base level, you've got teams and partnerships and international defense organizations. That is less so the case. My point is NATO is very multi-layer and thick, and we sometimes forget. Like, we just take it for granted how rich it is.
It's also its own bureaucracy that kind of allows
all that to come together.
That to come together, that process, and hey, they have established, relationships and so forth.
Exactly. And I think that in the Pacific, Asia Pacific region, it's very, it's much less complex, obviously, in terms of bureaucracy, but that's kind of a bad thing in many ways, because the U.S. is the glue that holds a lot of that together. And so it's really more of like a hub and spoke kind of model, where the U.S. is going to have a lot more of a burden on it, because partners aren't necessarily going to be, it's going to be bilateral, but like off, you know, it's going to be one-to-one relationships with each country versus getting all those countries to work together, especially in a conflict if it happened very soon. Because again, there is no NATO. And I guess my point is, in some ways, the U.S. is going to be the hub of that, but in other ways, it's going to be a problem to not have multilateral communication and multilateral training and things like that. So they're starting to get better about it, but it's here and there. It's not a formal alliance. They've never had that over there, and they don't have obviously a single cultural identity the way Europe did. So it's a little harder to probably build a NATO. But the U.S. will be in more of a central role over there, and that will create some advantages for us as the U.S. Some advantages for the U.S., but it will create a lot of tensions and problems as well, because country A, if that's the USA, can work with country B or country C or country D directly, but country B, C, and D may not work together at all, and that's hard to make an alliance or a coalition out of that.
So you know, from an industry perspective, it's one of the things that, one of the great aspects that of your job, and you know, through the Journal of Electromagnetic Dominance that you edit, you know, you take a look at kind of how the market is responding to this global change that's happening, you know, the threats and so forth, and what does it mean for the global defense electronics market? How is industry responding to some of these challenges of integration across country, across, you know, services and domains and so forth? How's the market responding? It's obviously doing very well here at, you know, by virtue of what's going on here at AOC 2022. But what are some of the trends that you're seeing industry take the lead on to address some of these challenges?
So I think industry is doing a good job of trying to find partnerships where they can, where they make sense. Again, there's usually, there's almost always some of the groundwork has been laid out at a military to military and government to government level, but there is sort of a if you do it right on the military side, you can get a certain amount of interoperability just by virtue of buying the same platforms with the same software on it, or very similar, you know, software on there. So, example, F-35. You know, F-16 was really the first one to say, hey, we have a lot of interoperability in F-16. We're all buying the same platform, maintaining it. They have not the same EW, but they have a lot of common EW in there, common radar, at least, you know, and you can get the rest of the standards kind of working together. So even the data links and things like that. So again, you can do that. I think that NATO has been more successful than Asia Pacific countries at that. But at the end of the day, the industrial base is where kind of the rubber meets the road on all those plans. And so they have to have incentives to work together, mm-hmm. and to work on supply chains and things like that together. And so I think that like F-35 is the next incarnation of that. But with the F-35, it's not its own thing. You need the entire, you know, ISR command control layer above that to get the whole sensor to shooter network to make the F-35 effective. And that's where interoperability and things like that also come in. It's not just buying a particular weapons platform. It's buying a whole constellation of them that work together, and then working with, maybe you don't have an airborne early warning aircraft or airborne command and control aircraft like an AWACS. So you've got to work with a partner who's feeding you radar tracks, even though that AWACS type aircraft is not available in your, you know, it's not yours. It's not your country.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank Battelle for their continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. It's always great to hear from them, and I am pleased to be here with Rusty Cole Morgan, Navy veteran and division manager at Battelle. Rusty, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've had an interesting career with extensive stints in the Navy and industry. What brought you to Battelle, and how does your experience align with Battelle's mission?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And I did have a very rewarding career as a Navy pilot. And as I transitioned through a number of companies in industry, I continued to have great experiences because I got the chance to work alongside eye-watering technical talent. What I'm most excited about at Battelle is how our campus is literally surrounded by an impressive depth of relevant applied researchers. That uniquely embedded in-house research capability serves as a foundation as we focus on solutions to the world's hardest problems. We strive to create a better world through science, and the RavenStar technology is the latest example of a hard problem with wide society benefits.
In the past, we've heard here on From the Crow's Nest from your colleagues, Doug Thornton and Molly Engel. They provided some intriguing insights about the RavenStar antenna. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenges of this trade space and what you're trying to address with this game-changing technology?
Well, the bottom line is that users have had to sub-optimize their capabilities and needs with traditional design approaches in the RF spectrum. Traditionally, electronic warfare and command and control users on a number of capabilities that create a challenging design space. Those needs are typically long ranges, maximum throughput, and low probability of intercept, low probability of detection. They want those ranges for more effective operational reach or standoff, and they want more throughput for the increased data that leads to actionable intelligence. And those tight control of the emissions, they want those for either maximizing energy on a particular bearing or limiting the ability to detect or interfere with their emissions. It's not an easy trade space, but the flexibility of the RavenStar architecture gives them more of what they want operationally.
So what does the RavenStar do that makes it optimized across these critical performance needs, and how does that stand out from traditional approaches?
Well, our frequency agility gives operators flexibility to work an ultra-wide portion of the spectrum through a single low-swap software-defined aperture. RavenStar co-designed extremely wide-band aperture arrays with co-located advanced electronics. And this allows a compact, frequency-flexible RF solution. Our approach minimizes conventional antenna feature trade-off and allows significant design flexibility for delivering the spectrum dominance that's needed.
We've been tracking this program here on the show. How mature is RavenStar today?
We put it at a TRL 6 after testing that we've done in December of 2023, and continuing into this year, we'll do field tests, accompanying lab demonstrations, and development performance on formal efforts with different DoD customers, all that are pointed toward a continued maturation of the RavenStar design. They show the RavenStar's ability is to support all domain missions that require multiple communications.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for joining me here on the show. It's always great to hear from the Battelle team. And now it's time to get back to our show.
So, you know, one of the themes that we keep hearing about, you know, it just gets to the point you're talking about, like, you know, getting the right system into the field. So we were talking earlier about, you know, innovation. It's a great buzzword. You know, you say the word innovation and all of a sudden people are like, oh, absolutely, we need innovation. But we also don't always look at it as, you know, you can innovate new things that you bring to the field that are bright shiny objects, great new capability. But then there's also the innovation of how you optimize what you currently have. Is from a market perspective, from an industry perspective, you know, how is industry kind of helping the defense agencies, U.S. DoD, as well as others, to figure out, okay, when we need to innovate, but we need to optimize what we have versus new capability, and helping these defense agencies pick and choose how to go about that with an innovation mindset.
Mm-hmm. So I think that one of the things that's happened over the past, I guess I'd almost say a decade, is there's a lot more experimentation in the field where it's kind of a call to industry, bring what you have. We have test equipment, or we have a test, some sort of evaluation that we can set up at one of the ranges in the U.S. or something like that. So bring what you have, and to me at least, the magic in that is having the industry experts, the technical experts, working directly with operational people, because those two, when they get together, mm-hmm. they're going to solve problems. The operator's really good at, say, you know, taking something that was built to do one job and modifying it in some way, or using it in a different way that the developer didn't think of. So that cross-pollination there, that's huge in terms of getting those ideas out there and getting that what I call, like what you call innovation, I kind of call it operational innovation.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. It's, you know, what you don't You don't have 5-10 years to develop what you need, so you got to go with what you have. I call it your sort of Apollo 13 moment. You know, here's your box full of stuff that's on that, you know, that you have to work with.
And I think it also it helps with operational relevance too, that, you know, you can have a great technology, but if it's not usable in the field in the heat of battle, mm-hmm. if you don't know how to use it, or it maybe interferes with something, or it just doesn't actually function in a way or in response to the way an adversary might be attacking, then it's not useful. So getting that warfighter kind of embedded earlier in development can kind of weed out some of that and make what you bring to the field actually work a little bit better or in what they need. So when we talk with, so the other aspect of this morning's show, when we kicked off, we went from international and we switched gears to talk about artificial intelligence and machine learning, algorithmic warfare, which is a word that I hope I don't have to say too often here on the podcast. I said it right there. But, you know, I think it's interesting because when we talk, you know, adaptability and agility of systems, you know, a lot of that gets into the software, gets into the software standards that we're using and the language, of course, the algorithms that really basically break everything down to a code that makes a system respond or work the way it needs to and learn on the fly. So we were talking earlier about the lexicon, the language between people. You also now have this notion of this language between machines and the algorithms that are used in the software. How do you see algorithmic warfare? How do you see the path that algorithmic warfare is on from the U.S. perspective and, of course, then from a coalition perspective in terms of what opportunities are in that space for improving how we conduct EMSO?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I have sort of a love-hate relationship with terms like algorithmic warfare, but I also can't speak that term. And the reason is because when you talk about algorithmic warfare or digital warfare or any of that, to me at least, it's overly reducing the what's important down to just technology or algorithms, or it's the same thing with electronic warfare and why we made the shift to electromagnetic warfare. Electronic warfare was named for a box, and that term, electronic warfare, in my opinion, saddled our community with everyone thinking that we were just about the box, and if I just throw enough money into the Coke machine, the Coke machine's going to give me a box, right? Mm-hmm. And that's all I have to worry about. I don't have to worry about people and leadership and organizations and all the rest of the .mil PF that makes that, it's everything working together, right? And so when you go to algorithmic warfare, you're reducing it beyond the box. Now you're just down to code, right? Now it's just, it's programmer warfare or whatever you want to call it. And so in that sense, I don't want to reduce further. The reason I like the shift from electronic warfare to electromagnetic warfare is because electromagnetic warfare is about responsibility, operational responsibility for a domain or mm-hmm. at least a maneuver space, a strategic maneuver space. And so we don't have F-22 warfare. We don't have missile warfare, air-to-air missile warfare, or AM-9X warfare, any of that stuff. We have air warfare because that's the operational responsibility for that space, for that domain. So when we invent new terms like algorithmic warfare, we're actually getting further down that rabbit hole of technology is the answer to everything. And if I just worry about technology, it solves all my other problems. I'm going to put all my money there. That's one side of my Jekyll and Hyde. You know, the other side of it is, if that's the term we have to use, things like algorithmic warfare, digital warfare, to emphasize the importance of this to leadership, it's again, not an ideal message, but if it gets the job done, if that's the only way to get people to invest in AI and understand the strategic importance of AI investment and things like that, then, you know, so be it. I guess that's just the way it's going to be. But I just hate to lose track of the idea that this is fundamentally about an operational responsibility, operational capabilities, operational decision-making. A playbook is not a technology playbook. It's an operational playbook, yeah. Right? EMSO playbook should be about EMS operations, not EMS technology playbook. Those are roadmaps and technology roadmaps and things like that. So for me, that's just my two cents on algorithmic warfare. Yeah. Is I'd like to see us talk about the importance of AI as a community without having to elevate the technology to a level by tagging the term warfare on it that gives it significance that it doesn't really have in the stack of things we worry about. So I don't know if that's it, you know.
No, that's good, because I think, you know, one of the things we've talked about a lot about is even just looking at the role of people training. There are a lot of components to operations that, you know, even from AEW's perspective, we've oftentimes struggled with lack of funding or lack of attention to, and we've oftentimes seen where the issue isn't technology. Like, we have the best technology out there today, and we've always have for generations, but as we're even seeing over in Russia and Ukraine, it's not just the technology they have, it's how you use it, how it works in a command and control environment, and so forth. So, you know, I think there's a lot of promise there. I think it's amazing, but at the end of the day, the algorithms are not, you know, it might be made through machine learning, but there's always a person behind there at some point, and you still have to make sure that those people understand exactly what they're contributing to in terms of the bigger picture or the bigger capability. You talked about operational responsibility and domains, and I'm going to use this as probably one of the most unnatural transitions. But looking at the JED, the monthly JED, the one here that is being distributed at the show, I wanted to bring you on to also talk about that a little bit, because the key feature is space. And, you know, so when you talk about operational responsibility in space, you have the Space Delta III Guardians, an article on that, a feature on that. So I wanted you to tell us a little bit about this article and what does that mean in terms of the context of this EMSO playbook? And, you know, it's a relevant article for this show, and explain, because we will be talking space later this week. But give us some insight into what went into this article and what are some of the lessons you pull out for both military as well as industry.
Sure. So I love that there's a Space Force. I think that's an absolutely, again, to me, domains exist because they're strategic and they're physical maneuver spaces for the most part, or at least some sort of maneuver space. And so space qualifies in both those categories. It's overdue, the recognition. It's if you thought about it in the past, you know, we thought of space and we just thought of satellites. Mm-hmm. We didn't think about contested space, or we did. If we did, it was not, again, in that whole .milpf enterprise type concept. And now Space Command has come along and they've really said, you know, like, we're not just a bunch of boxes that get launched into space, right? And so they've really thought about contested space and how, you know, how we're going to do that. And I think of the delineation I make is 21st century warfare versus 20th century warfare. 20th century warfare, the big thrusts were air, land, sea, right? And so you think about, okay, World War II, Vietnam, whatever it was, the conflict was less about what becomes important in 21st century warfare, which is in addition to air, land, sea, space, not replacing them, but what kind of glues them together in a joint environment, in a coalition, whatever. What glues those things together, in my mind at least, is cyber, space, and electromagnetic spectrum. So you could fight in the 20th century without really focusing on those last three things. But in the 21st century, the air warfare, naval warfare, land warfare only really gain credibility or gain, you know, they're only going to be you're going to win or lose in there because of space, cyber, and electromagnetic spectrum operations. And so space is a critical piece of that. It's one of those things, it shares a lot in common with EW, because you don't really see space. You know, you can maybe look up in your night sky at sunset or just after sunset and see satellites going overhead. But you just don't think about getting information from point A to point B, especially for a force like the United States, where you're projecting power globally. Even look at Ukraine, right? Look at how important Starlink is to them. What did Russia go attack the first week, you know, first few weeks of the war? They attacked Starlink because they knew that was a command and control communications system that the Ukrainian forces were using and still are. And so to me, space is this, again, strategic maneuver space, and you really have to, and it's, of all the domains, it's the most dependent on electromagnetic spectrum. You can't go up into space and tweak something. You're mm-hmm. delivering code up there, you know, with satellite communication. So you're looking at, you know, high dependence on the EMS more than any other domain, I think. And so again, and you just can't go to war, even inside your own borders, you can't go to war without space. Mm-hmm. And so that's just how ubiquitous it's becoming for us. So to me, I think it's just a really important, you know, field. And I EMSO is a huge piece of that. And we're going to spend a lot of time in JED going forward, fleshing that out in training and all the aspects that they're going to need to flesh it out.
So what are some of the upcoming additions? Obviously this was the October one on mm-hmm. space, but monthly publication. What's on the horizon then?
So the November JED, I actually wrote the cover story for that, the feature story for that, and that is talking to the 350th Spectrum Warfare Wing down in Eglin, and that to me was a great interview with Colonel Josh Kozlov, and he, very dynamic leader, very like. Perfect person to follow on from Colonel Young from Dollar, that's one of those things that I'm going to keep watching them, because where they're going is, to me, it's not perhaps completely unique to what other parts of the EW community are doing, but it is from where the Air Force was when, you know, we spent years talking about how's the Air Force really going to rejuvenate and get its EW mission back to where it needs to be in a peer competitor type environment, world with a lot of competition, that they have an idea of digital services. EW is a digital service. So they're taking their mission data, the old 53rd EW group, and they're changing what they do, but then they're adding to that these new digital services. So it's I don't want to liken it to, you know, your smartphone and anything, but they have a mission app, tactical app system. They have Missionware, which is like apps. They're really thinking about how to get capability out fast through software. They understand that how to get bypass the non-standard interfaces between two different weapon systems. So they're using things like Stitches. They did a thing called Project 212. They are, to me, showing. The very beginning of showing us what EW is going to look like in 10, 15 years. They're doing it really fast. They're reorganizing for that. So they're getting rid of their stovepipe sort of industrial era architecture that they had of the way they were set up. And they're very smart. They're very focused on what they want to do. But like, stay tuned. And anytime that they do something, take a look at what it is, because it's probably going to be something that it's not only what they're doing, it's different, but how they're doing it. And it's going to be very software-oriented organization, which I think, going back to, again, AI and everything, they're really interesting nerve center for the Air Force. Right people at the right time, too.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode. I want to thank you for once again joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. May try to pull you back in at a later time to kind of get your wrap-up thoughts here, because I think it's hard to speak right at the front end of the show when you haven't heard everything. But, you know, we've been around long enough that we can kind of understand what's going on here. But it's always great to talk with you, and look forward to continuing our conversation out the week.
Thanks for having me on. I always enjoy this. Thanks, Ken.
Well, that will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. Again, we're going to be bringing you a special episode each day this week. I want to thank my guest today, John Knowles, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Electromagnetic Dominance. Tomorrow, I have a special guest, Dave Tremper, from the Office of Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, to talk a little bit about EW program, acquisition, development, innovation. And then on Thursday, I sit down with our keynote speaker, Dr. Eric Hasseltine, who is an author, futurist, former intelligence officer with the NSA. He has a couple books out that we'll be talking about, focusing on innovation and how do you innovate in a bureaucracy. So a couple of other good guests coming up here in future episodes, and hope that you'll be able to download those and listen to those. That will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. I want to thank my guest, John Knowles, for joining me today. As always, we'd like to hear from our audience, so please rate, subscribe wherever you download your podcast. Thank you for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Battelle, the world's largest independent, not-for-profit, applied science and technology organization. Since 1929, their mission has been to translate scientific discovery and technology advances to benefit society. Through markets such as health, environment, infrastructure, industry, and national security, Battelle has been delivering cutting-edge solutions that impact the well-being of the world and help keep us safe at home. To learn more, go to battelle.org/connect. That's BATTELLE.org/connect.